Clouds. How about I just pause and let you fill in every other song, poem and saying about silver linings you can think of? Because the writer Richard Hamblin argues that clouds act like a magical screen onto which dreams, ideas, myths and legends are projected. And so his first book on watery vapour was The Invention of Clouds, but he didn't stop there. He's written two more since that book, and his latest is Clouds, Nature and Culture. He spoke to Michael Cathcart from London, and they started, of course, talking about the weather.
It's quite cloudy. It's pretty grey. There's some stratocumulus cloud up there, but there's a sun behind it that's going to burn them off. And it's going to be a fairly clear afternoon, I think.
That sounds lovely. How did you become a cloud man? How does this happen to a person?
Well, I remember very clearly as a child the first time I went up in an aeroplane. And it was quite a cloudy day. And I remember worrying that what's going to happen when we hit this, what appeared to be a solid white or grey layer above us. And then we went through it. And for a few minutes, we were actually inside a cloud. And then, you know, the way the plane just lifts up through the cloud and suddenly you're in this blue zone, this azure zone. The sunlight is incredibly bright. All of the colors are different. The light inside the airplane cabin is just incredibly kind of, you know, it's bright and clear. And that to me was a transfiguring moment. To pass through the clouds was elementally changing for me.
So that's how they've exercised the minds of small boys, as you were once. What about the minds of philosophers? Because in the book you cover quite a few philosophers. Just give us a taste of the reflections that have been stirred in the minds of philosophers when they gaze up at the clouds.
Yeah, well, for many centuries, people did not know anything about clouds because they are so far away. You can't grasp them. I think it's one of the fundamental qualities of a cloud is that it's far away from you. So that already is mysterious. You can't, unlike other forms of natural science, you can't take a sample of a cloud unless you're catching water in a rain gauge, but that's just a bucket of water in the end. Clouds are distant from us, yet, you know, they pass overhead. They're constantly changing. So they are mysterious in lots of ways. And philosophers like René Descartes, a great early 17th century French philosopher, thought that if you could philosophize about clouds, because they were so ungraspable, so changing, so such a challenge to our senses and our understanding, if you could philosophize about them, then you could philosophize about anything. So they became a kind of gold standard of difficulty, of graspability. And that's been a theme in philosophy, but also in literature, poetry, art, music. The ungraspability of clouds, you know, you can look at them, but you can't touch them.
They also seem ungraspable because they're constantly changing, they're constantly in flux. But along comes Luke Howard in 1802, and he manages to spot the continuities that are there and gives us the names that we still use. Tell us about Luke.
Yeah, well, he was, at that time, he was about 30 years old. He was a professional pharmacist. He'd had a long, unhappy apprenticeship as a pharmacist in England. He was a Quaker, and significantly, he joined an amateur scientific debating club in London, because Quakers at the time were forbidden from attending British universities. So they set up their own dissenting university. And the rule of the club was that every week someone had to give a lecture or pay a fine. And his joke was that, you know, he'd rather talk about clouds than pay a fine. But the truth was that he'd been fascinated by clouds for a long time, as had a lot of other people. And there had been attempts to name clouds before. But the main challenge, as you've suggested, is the fact that they change all the time. So if you can name a cloud, the problem is that 10 minutes later, it's another cloud. So naming them, it's not like naming a bird or a plant, which don't change every 10 minutes. You know, the average lifespan of a cloud is 10 minutes before it's changed into another one. So what he managed to do was come up with a series of names, but also a series of intermediate or compound names, so you could track the changes as the clouds change. So for example, the three main families of cloud that he named, the cirrus clouds, the high wispy ones, cumulus clouds, the big fluffy fat ones, and stratus clouds, the long, thin, low ones, a bit like fog. And the significance of his naming system was that something like a high cirrus cloud that descended and spread into a layer you could then call cirrostratus, stratus meaning layer. So you can see that there's is a kind of like almost like Lego blocks. You have a series of names and you can move them around one into the other. And that was the clever part. Anyone else who tried to name clouds before hadn't factored in their changeability. And Luke Howard's success was that he created a naming system that you could take parts of the name and move them around, a bit like blocks of Lego, and make other names which mirror the changeability of clouds themselves.
Now, as we'll see, there are a lot of artists and composers and so on who've been inspired by clouds, but the 18th century German thinker Goethe was actually inspired by Luke Howard's classification system.
He was. I mean, he was quite elderly at this time, and he'd been working on something he called morphology, the study of forms. And he was fascinated by the way that nothing in nature ever stays still. You know, he had this famous quote, "There is never a moment in nature where nothing can be said to be happening." You know, nature is a dynamic system or series of systems. He loved Luke Howard's classification. It was translated into German in 1815, and Goethe read it in German, and he saw immediately that this was a new kind of natural history classification, because it was a dynamic classification. It wasn't a grid. It wasn't, you know, an attempt to pin butterflies onto a board. This was allowing clouds to carry on moving, to have their elemental freedom. And he saw this, he called it a missing thread between scientific accuracy and creative freedom. And he wrote to Howard and said, "Please tell me about how you came up with this idea." And Luke Howard, I mean, Goethe was one of the most famous people in the world at that time, probably the great intellectual colossus of Europe. And Luke Howard, who was a very obscure, unknown pharmacist, thought this was a hoax from one of his friends and refused to answer the letter at first until he was persuaded that it really was Goethe writing to you. It's quite extraordinary. I mean, I can't think of an equivalent today, but it would be, you know, as though Al Gore wrote you a letter saying, "Please tell me about your views on the environment."
Well, Al, I'd say I quite like to walk on clouds. So as you say, Goethe is, well, he doesn't just write to Luke Howard, he also writes a poem about Howard's classification system. He gets rhapsodic about it.
He wasn't the only one. I mean, at the same time, Percy Shelley wrote his famous poem, The Cloud. And what's interesting is that both the Goethe poem and the Shelley poem take Luke Howard's sevenfold cloud classification and use that as the organizing principle of the poem. And in both these poems, it is, as it were, a single cloud that transforms from one kind of cloud, from a stratus cloud, into another kind of cloud, cumulus cloud, and so on. So what's interesting is that it wasn't just that Luke Howard's cloud names, which are very beautiful. I mean, I think that cumulonimbus is one of the most beautiful words in the language. But it wasn't just that they were responding to the beauty of the science. They were responding to the science itself, the ideas of the science. And Shelley's line, "I change but I cannot die," in his poem The Cloud, was very insightful, because that's exactly what Luke Howard was arguing, that a cloud doesn't die, it just changes into another cloud. Even when it evaporates and disappears completely, the water vapor is still there, latent in the atmosphere, waiting to become another cloud. So this, you know, you can see why Goethe would be very excited by this idea, that nature is this huge global system. It's not just one thing that you can point to. It's an entire series of systems all doing amazing things in the atmosphere.
Richard Hamblin's book is called Clouds, Nature and Culture, and Michael Cathcart also spoke to him about clouds of music and philosophy and all sorts of things. And you can check that longer version out at abc.net.au/rn and float about in Books Plus.